Rootslandnation.com. Listen to back episodes of the podcast. Stream original music. Check out the latest fashions. Rootslandnation.com. We're your culture.
Osiris.
The big stick.
The Rootsland Podcast. Stories that are music to your ears.
I've got no time, but I've got some time to eat your story.
Oh, take this veil from off my eyes.
By the early 1980s, Jamaica's top export had become reggae music. And like any other hot commodity, there were knockoff copies being made around the world and being passed off as the real thing. In the UK, where reggae music had become ingrained in the mainstream culture, a new wave of pop and rock bands, some who were formed during England's punk era, had incorporated reggae, dub, and ska into their various repertoires. The Specials, The Beat, Culture Club, UB40, The Police, and The Clash all had crossover hits on mainstream radio with their hybrid punk reggae sound or second wave ska spin-offs. Depending on who you ask and when you ask, this was either cultural appreciation, exposing a new generation to Jamaican music, or cultural appropriation of a ghetto art form for nothing but personal or financial gain. Either way, the jury was out on whether this new attention and crossover appeal would ever have a long-term impact for Jamaican music. One short-term benefit was that reggae, once relegated to and dependent on small community radio stations for airplay and exposure, was now catching the attention of larger commercial radio stations and their program directors. In the 1980s, progressive and indie rock radio stations across the U.S., recognized the underground growing influence of reggae, and of course the potential advertising revenue generated by the young people who followed the music. Major stations started producing and airing their own reggae mix shows and adding Roots radio hours into their lineups, usually on weekends, often late night. These shows and their eclectic hosts developed cult followings of musically curious teenagers, like me, fed up with the cold digital synth pop sound of the 80s, and looking for a more organic and meaningful music. Too young to drive or get into a club, Sunday nights at midnight on Long Island became sacred, listening to 92.7 WLIR's Punky Reggae Party, a two-hour radio extravaganza that was my pipeline into this unexplored world of reggae and all its various incarnations. New albums, tours, interviews, trivia. The Punky Reggae Party was hosted by Michael Epi Epstein and Larry the Duck Dunn, two white stoners from Long Island, highly educated in the fundamentals of reggae, and they sounded highly stoned on some monumental grippy. But they played some kick-ass tracks and understood how to connect the dots from Jamaica's musical roots to the modern-day groups that were influenced by and borrowed from the genre. The highlight of the show each week was a song they called The Big Spliff. They would choose a classic selection, like Junior Mervin's Police and Thieves, the haunting Lee Scratch Perry-produced track about the helplessness that ghetto people feel caught up in the middle of a never-ending cycle of violence, both who bear responsibility for the resulting carnage, as Mervin wails in his shaky falsetto. Police and thieves out in the streets, scaring the nation with their guns and ammunition, and all the crimes committed day by day. No one tries to stop it in any way. All the peacemakers turned war officers. So hear what I say.
Police and thieves in the street. Fighting the nation with their guns and ammunition. Police and thieves.
Epi and the Duck would then follow up Junior Mervyn's version with The Clash's 1978 rendition, a raw, aggressive take on the song that critics said stripped away the soulful nuances of the original version, turning it into just a straight-up protest anthem. Without any judgment, the DJs just played the tracks and let the listeners decide for ourselves. In the summer of 1983, 2 years after Bob Marley, the king of reggae, lost his fight with cancer, and right after I graduated high school, I attended my first real reggae concert in New York City. Me and my friend Andy Zucker, the lead singer in our high school reggae band The Spliff Masters, went to see music legend Peter Tosh, Bob Marley's former bandmate in the original Wailers. Tosh himself a revolutionary, a towering figure in the world of reggae. Literally, at 6'5" tall. The show was held at Pier 84 in Manhattan, an abandoned freight terminal on the city's west side along the Hudson River. The pier was the actual first stop for immigrants arriving in America, before being ferried off to Ellis Island. But from 1982 to 1987, the pier was transformed into a magical summertime concert venue, a platform for established acts like Peter Tosh, U2, The Talking Heads, as well as emerging cutting-edge rock, new wave, reggae, and world music talent. The urban West Side's industrial setting, located along the banks of the Hudson River, became a gathering place for the city's underground, avant-garde, and street culture. It's where young people like me, who came from the sheltered suburbs, could have new musical experiences that helped discover who we were and find new ways to express our own individuality. That night under the stars at the pier, the Bush Doctor, the Stepping Razor, the Mystic Man, Peter Tosh, lived up to all his monikers and beyond. I mean, talk about making an entrance. Tosh came on stage riding his famous unicycle, draped in white priestly garb, accented in red, gold, and green. His dreadlocks, blowing in the crosstown breeze, holding a blazing microphone in one hand and a burning spliff in the other. Peter Tosh entered chanting the biblical itations of Jah Rastafari. His deep baritone voice shook with indignation, and the New York City mob exploded. That's when I realized I wasn't alone. And this wasn't a music. It was a revolution.
Jah created Zion and earth. He then created man of his own likeness and image. He gave unto man wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. He made man dominion over all things.
My story was the same story as so many reggae fans throughout the 80s. It was all about these young, rebellious outcasts from the cities and suburbs. Restless teens who listened to reggae in their bedrooms, late at night in their pajamas, or down in their basements with the volume turned up to 11. Only to leave our houses and neighborhoods, head out into the world and discover we were part of a larger movement that transcended musical boundaries, race, color, or ethnicity. That night on the pier, there were business executives in Brooke Brothers suits, dancing with hippies in bandanas and tie-dyes. Black Americans, white Americans, Puerto Ricans and Asians, Muslims and Jews, models in high-heel shoes and miniskirts, grooving next to veterans in wheelchairs and on crutches. This was like a United Nations of conscious donors joining together as one family, putting aside differences for a common love, a higher purpose. And if this could happen here, even for just one night, I started thinking that maybe there was hope for such a divided world. And I wasn't alone. Around the same time, out in California, there was another young reggae fan, Jenje Dennis, who was also attending her first major reggae show. And it turns out, she was thinking the same thing.
California loved the roots, man. I mean, Dennis Brown, Gregory Isaacs, Wailing Souls. I mean, you know, Freddie McGregor. Oh my God, the roots. We love the roots on this side in the 80s. For me, that was my time, the 80s when I came in, my first reggae concert. I was like, what? And I was out here in Cali. It was May 14, 1983 at Cal State University, Long Beach. And the lineup was a phenomenal local band by the name of Small Axe, which quite a few of the members are still gigging. Ike Mouse, Marcia Griffith, and Freddie McGregor. My mind was blown. I couldn't believe this was happening. And wow. I went to that first reggae concert. I haven't been right since. I have reggae mellitus, definitely.
Yeah, I don't think there's a cure for it, but that may be okay.
Yes, so far, I guess, yes. I never forget. I think it actually brings tears to my eyes when I think of that first concert at the University of Cal State Long Beach, because there was a family there with a young daughter who obviously had Down syndrome. And she was dancing and skanking and nobody wasn't making much of her. And I couldn't believe she was so free to enjoy the music. Oh my goodness, it's so hard to say without crying.
Bob Marley sang Forget Your Troubles and Dance. And out in California, yo, they took that man serious. They danced on the streets and on the rooftops, in the stadiums and on the beaches. And of course, under the towering canopies in Northern California's Humboldt County, each summer as the pulse of reggae echoed through the ancient forests during the annual Reggae on the River, a festival that was born in 1984 as a humble fundraiser for the Mateel Community Center, a gathering place for the area's eccentric off-the-grid mix of friendly bohemians and reclusive anti-establishment cannabis growers, after it was burned down by an arsonist. Reggae on the River grew into this legendary event, where 15,000-plus tie-dyed souls would groove to the rhythms of Jamaica as the smoky aroma of jerk tofu mingled with the musky scent of the woods and high-grade sensimilia. And besides hosting some of the greatest names in reggae and world music, Reggae on the River exposed hundreds of thousands of music fans to Jamaica's top-shelf undiscovered talent long before they were popular. It also exposed countless stoners to Humboldt and Mendocino County's undiscovered growers and top-shelf indica and sativa long before it was legal. Reggae on the River wasn't the only California music festival to become a mecca for those seeking comfort in the sweet sound of reggae. One of the first on the scene was Ragamuffin Productions' Bob Marley Day Celebration. Starting in 1981 as a tribute to reggae's fallen king, the celebration filled arenas from San Diego to San Francisco every February for decades, with a multi-generational mix of musical styles that continually evolved as the genre did. And later came Warren Smith's Sierra Nevada World Music Festival, first held in Yuba County, Northern California's Gold Country region. Three magical days and nights of reggae and world music that took place every year during June's summer solstice. Then in 1985, a real game changer. Montego Bay, Jamaica's world-renowned international music festival, Reggae Sunsplash, would stage a touring version of the show for the UK and US markets. And this would see the genre's popularity climbed to new heights. Sunsplash was a ganja palooza, a Jamaican Woodstock with less organization and more sensimilia. Known for its late shows, long set changes, and constant sound issues, which all became part of the folksy island charm of the festival. And now, for the first time, a cross-country cavalcade of A-list ragamuffins and Rastafarians would be bringing the vibrations of the Caribbean and the revelations of Rastafari into the little nooks and crannies of mid-America. Still, California would continue to be the ground zero for reggae in the USA. And these festivals were a major reason why. They were lovingly organized, or should I say disorganized, by reggae fans themselves, whose respect and admiration for the music was the driving force behind promoting these events. Some that lost money for years. Maybe the greatest legacy of California's early reggae festivals in the 80s and 90s was how they evolved from becoming just concerts to a community. Family-friendly events where people would connect and reconnect year after year for decades. Come back long enough to bring their kids and then grandkids. Exposing an entirely new generation to roots reggae's mellow, uplifting vibes. But you know how kids are. They like to rebel against their parents. And as the 90s approached, Generation X turned out to be no different. This one-drop roots reggae, well, that was okay for mom and dad. But it didn't seem to go far enough to satisfy the unbridled energy of these kids. They wanted to take it one step beyond. And sometimes in order to go forward, you have to rewind.
One step beyond!
When people think about country music, they think about Musicians Row in Nashville. Punk rock? It's the Lower East Side in Manhattan. And for 80s metal hair bands, it's the Sunset Strip in LA. These are cities that reflect and project the music created on their turf, in their clubs, garages, and studios. Well, when it comes to reggae music, it's the fabled Orange Street in downtown Kingston, a sacred musical strip that has accurately been referred to as Beat Street. Home to notable reggae pioneers, Cox and Dodd, Lee Scratch Perry, Duke Reed, and shops like Randy Records, Augustus Pablo's Rockers International. And of course, the house that Ska built, the great Prince Buster's one-stop record shack. Orange Street was the nucleus of a burgeoning Jamaican music scene, starting in the late 50s, that evolved from small record shops selling R&B singles, imported from the States, to major production houses and record labels, producing and distributing Jamaica's own indigenous music. And by the late 50s, early 60s, that music was ska, an up-tempo groove with a hypnotic backbeat, blending elements of mento, jazz, and R&B, originated in the cramped rehearsal rooms at the famed Alpha Boys School in Kingston by aspiring ghetto musicians, perfected at all-night rum-infused jam sessions across the island. The ones responsible for the sonic and economic boom, the musicians, singers, and producers, well, they would hang out on Beach Street till the wee hours of the morning, burning herb, drinking beers, and talking shop. Artists would work out new material and bounce ideas off each other. It was an urban think tank, a musical incubator for legends like the Scatolites, Derek Morgan, Bob Andy, Desmond Decker, Alton Ellis, Delroy Wilson. A Jamaican musical renaissance like no other in time. By the mid-1960s, ska was the sound of choice being played on turntables everywhere in Jamaica. From the exclusive resorts located on the island's north coast, to the thriving downtown record stores on Orange Street. The very same shops that sold vinyl 45s like hotcakes, right off the presses to anxious young ska fanatics, radio DJs, and record aficionados. It wasn't only in Jamaica where ska was taking off. Literally, the new sound was on a cross-continental trip over the Atlantic. A journey that would have a cross-cultural impact on the UK that would last for generations. In 1948, a ship named the HMT Empire Windrush carried 1,027 passengers and two stowaways on a voyage from Jamaica to London. I loved how they kept that stat. The Windrush became a symbol for a generation that arrived in the UK from the Caribbean between 1948 and 1971. having been granted Commonwealth citizenship by the British government. These immigrants fled their impoverished islands, often with only the shirts on their backs or clothes in their bags, searching for better opportunities, hoping to build better lives as strangers in a strange land. They settled into the working-class communities of Brixton, Manchester, and Birmingham, helped rebuild a war-torn country, working long hours for low pay in unfamiliar conditions, sent whatever they had extra back home to the families they so desperately missed and longed to see. For these Caribbean newcomers, known as the Windrush Generation, ska became an instant and gratifying connection to life back home on the islands. Those same songs that were blasting at street dances in Kingston were playing in their local London basement parties. More than just great music to dance to, these were stories about life and love, politics and play. The world's oldest means of communication, song, was also the newest. Trojan Records, an independent label based in London, stepped into the market and distributed these records. They played an essential role in the growth of ska in England and helped it reach a wider and whiter audience. As reggae DJ and historian Don Letts recalls,
Trojan Records, launched in 1968, the same year that Enoch Powell made the Rivers of Blood speech. So while he's freaking out the old white people with his poisonous politics, it was the music of Trojan Records that was uniting the youths on the street. And that was the soundtrack of the country's first multicultural subculture, skinheads. And I'm talking now about the fashion version, not the fascist version that came along in the early 70s. You dig what I'm saying? So it's really Trojan Records that sowed the seeds of the UK's love affair with Jamaican music.
Those original skinheads, known for their close-cropped hairstyles and blue-collar fashion, with suspenders and Doc Martin boots, came from the same working-class neighborhoods as the newly arrived Caribbean immigrants. These British youth embraced the energetic and rebellious spirit of the Jamaican ska. The skinheads went to the clubs and dance hall where the music was played, became kindred spirits with their Jamaican rude boy brethren. Ska became an integral part of their identity. Jamaican producers, with their always savvy business minds, got hold of the trend, eventually began producing exclusive tracks to exploit this new market, recognizing the skinheads as a legitimate movement.
I want all you skinheads to get up on your feet. Put your braces together and your boots on your feet. And give me some of that old moon stamping.
But things change as they always do. And in the music business, change is swift. In 1966, there was a stifling heat wave in Jamaica. It was the hottest summer on record in Kingston, a city where one's style and fashion are as important as their moves on the dance floor. And since no Jamaican wants to sweat up and spoil their newly bought outfits, the DJs were forced to cool down the pace, which marked the end for Jamaican ska and ushered in the era of the singer and rocksteady music, roots reggae's older brother. This also meant that the steady stream of hot new ska releases being sent via Kingston to UK would also cool down and soon dry up. Trojan Records, which had an incredible run of hits with artists such as Jimmy Cliff, Bob and Marcia, The Upsetters, The Pioneers, would eventually shutter its offices, signaling the end of an era. In addition, the skinhead culture would be infiltrated and commandeered by white nationalists. As Don Letts describes, the fascist skinheads, not the fashion skinheads. Ska would become associated with racism and violence, and many people became alienated from the music that once brought people together. Decades after those original Ska 45s were released by Prince Buster and Blue Beat, Cox and Dodd and Treasure Isle, an era may have ended, but that music could never die. As Bob Marley would say, it just simmers down, only to have the flame grow hot again and the pot boil over. What spilled onto the stove in the late 70s, early 80s was ska's second wave. The two-tone ska revival movement emerged from the gritty urban working-class cities of Coventry and Birmingham, led by the Specials, The Beat, Bad Manners, and Madness, whose cover of Prince Buster's One Step Beyond was a crossover hit. This new fusion was a mix of the traditional ska from Jamaica with the attitude and energy of 70s punk rock. No coincidence, since many of the seminal players of punk, including the Sex Pistols, the Slits, and the Clash, were heavily influenced by ska, reggae, and dub music, which they proudly wore on their leather sleeves and loudly incorporated into their sounds. This second wave of ska didn't go unnoticed, least of all in California, especially in the OC, Orange County, and nearby Long Beach, Cali. The frantic pace of the music, the infectious grooves, the injection of punk values and a general don't-give-a-fuck mentality resonated with a frustrated suburban skate and surf culture. And best of all, this wasn't mom and dad's reggae. The stage was now set for an upcoming West Coast musical tsunami. Well, it wasn't as much a stage as it was a deck patio in a small beachfront backyard. And the beach bash really couldn't get started until two other guests showed up to the party. One, a confused engineer in Jamaica, whose costly mistake turned out to be a keeper. And the other, a Japanese college student obsessed with Bob Marley, whose dream job at a digital watch company in Tokyo would forever change the course of reggae music and its journey from Kingston to Cali.
Hey, you! Don't watch that! Watch this! This is the heavy, heavy monster sound! The nuttiest sound around! So if you're coming off the street and you're beginning to feel the heat, well, listen, Buster, you better start to move your feet to the rockinest, rock-steady beat of Madness. One step beyond!
RootslandNation.com. Listen to back episodes of the podcast. Stream original music. Check out the latest fashions. RootslandNation.com. Wear your culture.